dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The Justice Robert Jackson Conference on the Planning for the Prosecution of High-Level American War Criminals was held mid-September at the Massachusetts School of Law in Andover, convened by its dean, Lawrence Velvel. As one speaker commented, this conference differed from most in the academic setting in that it proceeded from the conclusion that crimes had been committed and addressed itself toward accountability and deterrence. At the conclusion of the two-day event, participants solicited commitments of work towards that goal and formed a steering committee to oversee the ongoing work. This week, I'm going to play you the first panel, Crimes of Torture and Degrading and Abusive Conduct, and Perpetrators and Punishments, featuring three experts in law and public policy, Josh Trattell, Christopher Pyle, and Philippe Sands. In order to put you at that same starting point, that the crimes are a given, last week I played a radio adaptation of a documentary, Torturing Democracy, that showed the evidence as well as those responsible. The panel and audience questions will take about an hour and a half, and then we'll conclude with the next installment of the reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The conference opened with remarks from Dean Velvel, which did not get recorded due to technical problems. According to the published agenda, Velvel's introductory remarks stressed that crimes and misconduct have now occurred twice in 40 years, in Vietnam and then again in Iraq, and the high-level perpetrators need to be punished, as occurred at Nuremberg and Tokyo in 1945 and 1946. In order to ensure that people will not do these things again, as the Germans and Japanese have not committed their crimes again. Justice Robert Jackson, for whom the conference was named, was a Supreme Court justice who served as the Chief United States Prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. He said in his opening statement there, quote, "The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated. This tribunal, while it is novel and experimental, is not the product of abstract speculations, nor is it created to vindicate legalistic theories. This inquest represents the practical effort of four of the most mighty of nations, with the support of 17 more, to utilize international law to meet the greatest menace of our times, aggressive war. The common sense of mankind demands that law shall not stop with the punishment of petty crimes by little people. It must also reach men who possess themselves of great power and make deliberate and concerted use of it to set in motion evils which leave no home in the world untouched." Close quote. One can't help but notice how routinely the crimes of the powerful go unpunished, while the weight of the law falls routinely upon the little people, such as the millions sentenced to decades in prison for their possession of certain banned drugs. In New York State, the penalty for possession of 4 or more ounces of marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and similar substances is a mandatory 15 years to life, What then should be the consequences for planning and carrying out the torture, kidnapping, and murder of thousands or millions? I know that many Americans don't understand why the sight of the American flag fills some of us with such revulsion. It is because those who commit monstrous acts wrap themselves in it, and as a result face no consequences. While we, the little people, have our lives destroyed for violating thousands of inconsequential and arbitrary rules and regulation, whose enforcement deprives us of so much joy and ease. The first speaker on the panel we're about to hear is Josh Tretel, who served as a civilian attorney for Guantanamo detainee David Hicks and is the co-author with Karen Greenberg of The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib.
I think it's fitting, and obviously that it's called the Justice Jackson Conference for obvious reasons, but in preparing, it reminded me of a quote from Justice Jackson at the opening of the trial of Hermann Göring at Nuremberg that I was preparing to use in the context of my representation of David Hicks, an Australian detained at Guantanamo when he faced a military commission in which I represented him, and which in many ways generated my involvement in the torture papers, the volume that became the torture papers. But what Justice Jackson said was, "We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants today is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poisoned chalice is to put it to our own lips as well. We must summon such detachment and intellectual integrity to our task that this trial will commend itself to posterity as fulfilling humanity's aspirations to do justice." And that principle, to me, is what was missing and what has been missing from the very beginning of this administration's response to September 11th. And it is an abandonment, essentially, of all of those principles. And the irony now is that perhaps as responsibility passes to us or to a next administration to seek accountability, that again we not lose sight of that principle in search of justice for those who have been responsible for the crimes of the last 8 years. And I come to this as a criminal defense attorney. That's my profession. That's always been my profession. And to that, I bring a perspective of someone who is not terribly fond of prosecutions generally, and not terribly fond of prosecutions that have as their origin political objectives. So in the context of political prosecutions, I am somewhat dubious in terms of what they can accomplish across the board in terms of the ultimate objectives that I would like to see in the context of accountability, of punishment. But most important to me is deterrence. As someone who has, again, represented people charged with crimes, some of whom are guilty of crimes, and some of them are heinous, inexcusable crimes. The redeeming values of people are not always evident, obviously, from what is portrayed in terms of their worst moments, the crimes they commit, and the public perception of it. And this is not a defense of either the conduct that people have committed or of anything else about them, but just to avoid prejudgments and preconceptions. And to me, retribution, and I know there's a lot of emotion involved in this due to the nature of the conduct that we're talking about punishing. To me, as a criminal defense attorney, retribution is probably the least important factor in my approach. The most important factor in my approach is deterrence. And if it meant that not a single person responsible for these acts went to jail or was prosecuted or convicted, but in its place, there was some mechanism for preventing it from happening in the future, I would trade those in a second. However, sometimes, obviously, you can't have one without the other because people need incentives to do good and disincentives to do wrong. What's interesting to me and what was interesting to me when I first became involved in assembling the torture papers with Karen Greenberg, my co-editor, was the career paths of those involved in this process, in the sense of those involved on the civilian side, in the Office of Legal Counsel, those involved on the military side who essentially implemented the administration's plan, as opposed to those who did not, as opposed to those who resisted. And there was a tremendous culture within the military to resist. And I think that has to be understood in the context of what types of forms are used, whether it's a criminal prosecution form or a Truth and Reconciliation Committee model that is used. But in the career paths, you have someone like Jay Bybee, a principal author of one of the worst torture memos, becoming a judge on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, lifetime appointment, basically insulated now, unless he is obviously prosecuted for his prior conduct. There's nothing that insulates him from criminal conduct. But in terms of a career path, very rewarding to do what he did. John Yoo, professor at Berkeley, very rewarding. I think that as a threshold principle for me is, rather than punishment, we start with the denial of rewards for such conduct. First, you have to get there before you can start to create disincentives for people to conduct themselves in the manner in which they have. And there are tremendous, you know, one of the other problems with a prosecution across the board that looks to punish people is there are tremendous institutional pressures against such a process. The military, the Department of Defense, the executive, the Attorney General, even those who come after with a clean slate are going to be resistant to the notion that decisions in those contexts are reviewable and viewed in hindsight in a manner by some succeeding administration. It's going to be very difficult to get the kind of across-the-board, I think, it's going to be very difficult to get the kind of across-the-board, not only in the context of justice, but just in the context of information, in the context of trying to get to the bottom of what occurred, which to me is very important in the context of accountability. Because I think accountability is really about how the system in which these decisions were made. Some of the decisions that to me were at the time in 2004 and 2005 were less apparent than they are now. But even still now, even with people on the record, off the record, you don't have necessarily a open and shut case against a variety of people, perhaps against some, but not against all. And the question is, when you talk about accountability, is sort of, to me, the chicken and the egg question was always an easy one in that, and I guess we'll talk about this more in the next panel as well, and so I don't want to do it all at once, but in the context of lawyers and how lawyers develop opinions and lawyers develop legal positions, intuitively it was that it was coming from somewhere else and that it was generated outside for the lawyers to do something, to come up with a result rather than look at a problem objectively. It was really a result-oriented process, which in many ways it is in the legal profession, but I'll discuss that in the next panel. That doesn't absolve lawyers for their conduct, but again, that also creates certain barriers to creating a accountability that comes with some sort of punishment in the criminal context. I felt this from the beginning because of my experience with prosecutions, they're the pros and the cons, what can be accomplished, what is often not accomplished, what often they devolve into is scalp hunts rather than searches for the truth, rather than investigations that are designed to reform. They are often designed to promote someone else's career. They are often designed merely to pick out examples. And there are some, and there are advantages to symbolic, and this is maybe one of those examples, like Watergate, where there is a symbolic purpose to a handful of people going to jail for particular activity that is just so beyond the pale that we cannot tolerate it. But in terms of trying to stop it from happening again and trying to get a broader sense of accountability, and it's not just to me accountability for those who have done what they have done and for the administration as it has existed the past 8 years, because really when you look at accountability and look at the context of what we're talking about today in terms of war crimes, it's really repeated throughout the administration and the whole decision-making process, whether it's hiring decisions at the Justice Department, whether it's Guantanamo, whether it's Iraq, they all have a pattern. And unfortunately, one of the patterns is that there's no pattern in the sense that there's very little planning, very little long-range planning. But for me, accountability is really accountability going forward, which is that the next person in that position will feel accountable. And obviously, there are ways to do that. One is to make someone afraid that they're going to jail. But I can tell you that no one in a position in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice thinks they're going to jail for doing something. There's just a built-in insulation there of power that generally prevents that. To me, a far more salutary mechanism would be openness. And again, we'll get into this more with respect to the legal panel this afternoon, but the secretiveness in which these policies were devised and the lack of contribution from dissenting voices is what I think made them able to win the day from the beginning, and second is to perpetuate for so long before they raised outrage on the part of the public. So for me, openness and no legal opinion should ever be considered classified that sets forth a policy of the United States with respect to whether we're going to abide by the Geneva Convention, whether we're going to break the law that we have ratified and the law of nations. So from my perspective, again, in terms of looking at what are the advantages and disadvantages of ordinary prosecutions, I have been for years and still favor an independent commission outside of government that is sufficiently empowered with subpoena power and other investigative powers to perform an investigation first and make findings first before getting into the question of punishment and penalties, because I think that accountability and deterrence come from a recognition by those who follow that their decisions are reviewable and that their decisions are open to the public. And for many of these people, their careers are really their first line of what they're thinking about. They're not thinking about jail when they make these decisions. They're thinking about what promotes their career. And if we can stop that first, we will be 90% of the way along to stopping people from making these kinds of decisions, thinking that it's a good thing as opposed to a bad thing. We have to make it a personal one, I think, in many ways. But the question is how best to do that without running into, again, institutional opposition and just the problems with criminal prosecutions as I see them across the board. Thank you.
That was Josh Dratel, defense attorney of Guantanamo detainee David Hicks, and co-author of The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib. The next presenter is Chris Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College. In 1970, Pyle disclosed the military surveillance of civilian politics, and as a consultant to three congressional committees and the American Civil Liberties Union worked to end it. His most recent book, Extradition, Politics, and Human Rights, analyzes how the United States has treated political fugitives from the regicides of colonial times to the suspected terrorists and war criminals of today.
I'd like to begin by thanking the good dean for sponsoring this conference. This is the first conference sponsored at an academic institution that I know of that contemplates doing something about government criminality rather than just talking about it. Most academic conferences I know would not start with the conclusion that crimes have been committed and move on from there. They would want to rehash whether crimes have been committed so that they can be fair and balanced. And that might have been appropriate as recently as 2004. when some of the evidence was still unclear. Today, however, the evidence is overwhelming. The torture, kidnapping, and degradation of suspected terrorists, many of whom, as the dean has said, were innocent, was part of a deliberate policy hatched and concealed at the highest levels of the Bush administration. This is not a partisan conclusion. Administration lawyers acknowledged that criminality in secret documents as early as January 2002. That's why they persuaded the president to decree that the Geneva Conventions did not apply. They knew it was criminal. They had to do something to muddy the legal waters. And when the Supreme Court rejected their bogus claim in 2006, the president persuaded his party in Congress to grant them amnesty for their crimes. That, too, is a tacit admission of criminality. Excuse me. The weight of legal opinion has always been against the administration. That's why it kept its legal opinions secret. Today, even Attorney General Mukasey will not deny that waterboarding is a crime. He simply refuses to say that it is a crime. Because if he admitted the obvious, he would have to prosecute the criminals. The best excuse that Mukasey can give is a version of the Eichmann defense. Lawyers said we could do it. Do not try this at home. When this is the best defense that the administration can offer, it would be an empty exercise to discuss yet again whether they have committed crimes. Precisely which crimes and which statutes, yes, that's open for discussion. But the general conclusion that criminal activity has occurred and we need to consider indictments, I think, is indisputable. To paraphrase John McCain, it is no longer about them. It is about us and what we intend to do about these crimes. Some people may accuse us of being partisan, but that is silly. We would be here addressing the same questions had these crimes been committed by Democrats. This is not a campaign event. It is a conference about how to restore government accountability in the wake of a criminal administration. It addresses the most serious constitutional crisis in our nation's history. The claim that the president and his secret agents can get away with torture, kidnapping, and even manslaughter. The question before us is not whether the torture team, as Philippe Sand so wisely called them, deserves to be prosecuted, but whether anyone can be persuaded to do it. And it is not about prosecuting one administration, as the impeachment of Bill Clinton was about removing one president. It is about reversing a 50-year trend toward unaccountable secret government, which now commits crimes with impunity. Punishing the torture team is just a beginning. We also need to change the laws and legal doctrines, like the state secrets privilege, that are now transforming the United States from a constitutional republic to an elected monarchy. And like many of you, I'm not sanguine about the possibilities. But I believe that prosecutions are essential if our country is to regain its moral standing in the world and if we are to restore the rule of law at home. Of course, prosecuting the torture team would constitute a major political commitment on the part of the next administration. And unfortunately, there would be very little political payoff for such a move. McCain's party would not permit it. They were complicit. When Joe Biden endorsed the idea, Obama's managers forced him to recant. Obama has promised to have his attorney general look into the possibilities, but has made it clear through his gentleman-in-waiting that he does not want to spend his first term on such a divisive issue. What this means, I fear, is that he intends no prosecutions at all. Because by the time his second term rolls around, if he has one, the defendants may be able to argue that the various statutes of limitation on conspiracy have run out. Of course, prosecutions cannot be undertaken without first repealing the amnesty provisions of the Military Commissions Act, which the Democrats may fear to do, so long as the voters want revenge and can't sort out these questions. Now, some commentators, including Stuart Taylor of Newsweek and Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, have argued for an independent truth commission. A commission with subpoena powers instead of a congressional investigation and congressional hearings. Only by forswearing prosecutions, they say, will administration officials be persuaded to confess their sins. But if there's no threat of punishment, and therefore no prospect of plea bargains, why would anyone admit anything? Others have argued that elections informed by investigations are the best way to hold presidents accountable for their crimes. But George W. Bush was reelected despite widespread knowledge of his criminal activity, proving yet again that elections are not the best guarantee of government under law. And let's face it, truth commissions are for countries that have experienced a total breakdown of law and order, and which have more criminals than they can possibly prosecute. American commissions are rarely given the time or money to get to the bottom of a scandal and encounter all sorts of obstacles to acquiring documents, depending on which party controls the White House. Unlike congressional committees, commissions can't push reforms on Capitol Hill. To the officials being investigated and the politicians who support them, the chief function of a commission is to run out the clock while fostering the illusion that reform is on the way. If the threatened political party cannot protect itself from congressional hearings by appointing a docile commission, its members in Congress will typically urge the creation of an ad hoc joint committee of Congress. Joint committees are easier to disrupt, because the House and Senate have conflicting ambitions and conflicting schedules. The natural rivalry of House and Senate members can be exploited, as Dick Cheney did when he was on the Iran-Contra Committee. Should the members of an ad hoc committee actually agree on some proposals, they will lack the authority to push them through Congress. Now, as we all know, we don't really need an ad hoc body to determine the truth about the torture policy. The broad outlines of that and some of the evidence is overwhelming already. What we need is proof that our legal system still works and that American presidents and their co-conspirators cannot get away with torture. Televised hearings can help get this message across. They can build support for prosecutions. And they can point the way toward legislative reforms. But there's still the question of who should hold those hearings. Within Barack Obama's campaign, support has been expressed for something like Senator Frank Church's Select Committee on Intelligence, a temporary body which employed a bipartisan staff and effectively investigated wrongdoing by intelligence agencies under both Democratic and Republican administrations. And I certainly have fond memories of the Church Committee. I worked on it. But that committee existed before Congress created permanent standing committees of both houses to oversee intelligence matters. Those committees are now well entrenched. They will not look kindly on the creation of an ad hoc committee to do their work, and in the process expose their failure at legislative oversight. Proponents of another Church committee also forget that the report of the House counterpart, the House committee led by Otis Pike of New York, was suppressed by the full House of Representatives on national security grounds. It was later leaked to Daniel Shore. But it's easier to suppress a report on national security grounds than it is to suppress a report about criminal activity, which is why the hearing should be entrusted to the Judiciary Committees of the House and Senate. They not only have subpoena powers, they also they also have the capacity to push legislation through Congress. They can write it, they can propose it, they can shepherd it through Congress. And I hope they will get that authority, because I have a few favorite bills I would like to see passed. I'll mention just one. And that is a bill which would require the videotaping of all custodial interrogations and the independent archiving of those videotapes. And I mean all custodial interrogations by intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies, military agencies. I want the word to go out to all interrogators: smile, you are on candid camera. Prosecution of the torture team should begin, of course, as soon as the amnesty law can be repealed. And the prosecutors presumably would target the underlings first and use plea bargains against this to get evidence against their superiors, including Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Gonzalez. Whether George W. Bush is indicted is probably less important than sending a clear signal to cabinet-level officials that they had better obey the criminal law, no matter what their president and his legal lackeys say. Now, should President Bush pardon himself and his subordinates in advance of prosecution, that, I believe, is worth contesting. It is one thing for a president to grant mass amnesties, as Andrew Johnson did after the Civil War. It is something else for a president to pre-pardon himself and his subordinates in order to prevent prosecutions for crimes that they have committed while in office. Pre-pardons are not pardons. They're obstructions of justice. President Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon was a pre-pardon. It was intended to obstruct justice. But that precedent could be modified by legislation, stating that presidents may only pardon persons who have actually been convicted of a crime, and that no president can pardon himself. Otherwise, election to the presidency will become a license to torture, kidnap, and kill with impunity, and the United States will become an elected monarchy. There is also the question of who should do the prosecuting. Ideally, the Justice Department should be in charge, if only to restore its integrity, which has been battered through these years. But that does not preclude the appointment of a nonpartisan prosecutor with considerable independence, much as Attorney General Elliot Richardson did when he appointed Archibald Cox to lead the Watergate team. A special prosecutor could be chosen by the next Attorney General from among any number of distinguished Republican attorneys. If Congress and the Justice Department are not up to this task, and I fear they are not, then the Attorneys General of Virginia and Maryland might consider tackling parts of it. I know this is highly remote, but it's worth remembering to all of us that nothing in the Constitution or federal law bans the enforcement of state laws against federal officials who conspire to commit crimes while on state soil. The federalist system works in both directions, or could if we had the will. If the new Congress and President choose not to prosecute the torture team, then the way is at least theoretically open for foreign trials. The President and two-thirds of the Senate are not likely to ratify the Rome Statute and submit to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. But the next president could revoke the non-extradition agreements that John Bolton negotiated and allow the Justice Department to facilitate extradition proceedings on behalf of any European court with universal jurisdiction over war crimes. The legal obstacles to prosecuting the torture team are substantial, but no more daunting than those that Argentina and Chile faced after their generals, like Bush, obtained immunity for their dirty wars. Whether our nation will take as long as those countries to bring its torturers to justice remains to be seen. But failure to prosecute now almost certainly will lead to demands to prosecute later. This is not an issue that is likely to go away. Thank you.
That was Professor Chris Pyle.
The last panelist, far from the least panelist on this panel, is Professor Philippe Sands from University College London. Philippe.
Thank you very much, Dean Velvel. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm, of course, something of an outsider, although I know many people in the audience. And I come from the United Kingdom, which, of course, shares a very similar legal culture and a political tradition. And as an outsider, I think it behoves me, in a sense, to be somewhat circumspect in making recommendations to other countries as to how they should deal with internal situations. There's a notable reticence, I think, on the part of people who are visiting to lay down the gauntlet. I'm here, I think, because I wrote a book called Torture Team, which goes into very considerable detail on the story of the interrogation of one man by reference to the famous memorandum that was signed by Donald Rumsfeld on the 2nd of December 2002, authorizing the use of 15 new techniques of interrogation on Mohammed al-Qahtani, detainee 063. My background is as a lawyer. I'm a professor at the University of London, and I'm a barrister, I'm a litigator, and I approached the task of writing this book, gathering the evidence, assessing the law, assessing the obligations, wearing both an academic hat and a practitioner's hat. In my background, I've been involved in many cases involving the Commission of International Crimes. I was deeply involved in the case before the House of Lords concerning the extradition of Senator Pinochet from the United Kingdom to Spain. And in a sense, that case was the sort of high watermark for the proposition that no one, not even a former head of state, is entitled to immunity from the jurisdiction of courts so far as certain international crimes are committed. That crime, of course, concerned the crime of torture. probably many of you here haven't been to the House of Lords, and so you wouldn't know what the courtroom is like. It's not quite as sort of well arranged as your Supreme Court. It's a very tiny committee room. Everyone is crammed in very closely. I was acting as counsel for one of the interveners, Human Rights Watch, but I was sat next to one of Senator Pinochet's advisers throughout all of the hearings. And there were two different sets of hearings, as some of you will know, Pinochet number one and then Pinochet number three. And in those hearings, I sat next to a gentleman who was Senator Pinochet's human rights advisor from 1977 to 1984. And the curious thing, and others of you here who are lawyers will know, is that once you're in a courtroom in that context, there's a sort of civility that emerges. You sit next to the same person day after day after day, and however much you may disapprove of what he has been associated with, you do build up a sort of relationship in which you converse, you talk about things, and with the passage of time, things go slightly your way, things go slightly their way, and you start talking. And what struck me most in that conversation, I think it's very pertinent to the conversation that you're having today, was one thing that he said to me. He was the man who advised Senator Pinochet to ratify the Torture Convention, the 1984 Torture Convention, that provides that there is an obligation to extradite, to investigate and prosecute, or to extradite to any country for extradition or for prosecution, where the crime of torture has been committed. And at one point he said to me, you know, Philippe, it simply never occurred to us when we ratified the Torture Convention that 15 years later we would find ourselves in a situation in which that very convention became the instrument which removed Senator Pinochet's immunity from extradition from the United Kingdom to Spain. And I think the lesson that I drew from that was that you can never quite know what is going to happen or how it is going to happen. The other lesson that I draw from that is that the events involving the arrest and extradition efforts for Senator Pinochet, which from my perspective I have to say were largely successful, because it was that set of events that transformed the domestic political situation in Chile, they happened more than 25 years after his worst crimes were committed. They happened more than 10 years after he left office. I think the lesson that one picks up is very often it takes time for the full consequences of gross wrongdoing to play themselves out. And I think we have to remind ourselves that notwithstanding the situation that pertains right now in the United States in relation to the story that I tell, the commission of war crimes by administration officials against one detainee at Guantanamo, it is still, in the global scheme of things, early days. There is a lot of evidence out. There is a lot of information out. But there's also a great deal more information that is needed before we can really understand precisely who was involved in what decision at what particular time. And it does take time for these things to come out. And it's right that some caution needs to be exercised in deciding precisely how to proceed, for the very simple reason that history also tells us that early and premature efforts that are not fully thought through can have backfire consequences. It's better when it is done to get it absolutely right than to do it in a sort of half-hearted or incomplete way. That's another experience from a lot of the international proceedings that have taken place. My perspective is also then one of a British national. Why is that relevant? Why is that significant? I think it might be some comfort to everybody in this room to know that in Britain, the response to the stories that have emerged, to the story that I've told, is completely different from the response in the United States. It is across the political spectrum, from left all the way to the right, absolute horror about what has happened. To give you an example of that, when my book came out in the United Kingdom in April, the keynote speaker at the launch event was our Chief Justice, Lord Bingham, said a few introductory words from a carefully prepared script to, in effect, indicate his degree of support for the subject matter of this book. Imagine for a moment the situation in the United States if I were to have an analogous launch party here where the Chief Justice John Roberts could be seen to be citing with approval a book called Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo, and the Betrayal of American Values. I think it indicates that something has changed very significantly in the United States. It's been very difficult for people who hold different views from me to attack me as being someone who bears a grudge against the United States. It's blindingly obvious to anyone who's read this book and to anyone who has read my previous book, Lawless World, that I hold the United States in great professional affection and in great personal affection. My wife's a New Yorker. My kids were born in the States. As I said when I testified for the first time in the House Judiciary Committee after the book came out and the Vanity Fair piece came out, I'm deeply proud of the fact that my kids share British and American nationality. And I was advised that I needed to say things like that. You can't say things like that when you're testifying in the United Kingdom. It's seen to be extremely tacky and extremely inappropriate. But here I knew I had to say it, and I meant it. I spend an awful lot of time in this country, and I'm acutely aware that in the period since the Second World War, no country, frankly, has done more than the United States to contribute to the creation of a rule of law. Sometimes that's not a popular thing to say. No doubt there'll be people in this room who will disagree fundamentally with that, and no doubt it's right that the United States has been associated with some very bad things. But what was different about this story was that it was formalized and it was institutionalized. There was previously no piece of paper like the memo signed by Donald Rumsfeld, in which he said, at the bottom, in his own handwriting, "Why standing limited for 4 hours? I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day." This is a step change in the United States' engagement with the rule of law. And for that reason, it is particularly serious. It's particularly serious because it gives rise to criminality. It's particularly serious because it is wrong. It's particularly serious because it undermines us and who we are and the values that we care about. And it's particularly serious, and I care deeply about this, because it undermines the ability of really the only country in the world that can actually promote an international rule of law from prosecuting that effort. And that is why I think a lot of attention has to be given as to what needs to be done in these circumstances. I'm not now going to recount to you the entire story that I told in the Vanity Fair piece, The Green Light, or in the book Torture Team. Some of you will have read it, you'll be aware of it. I'm happy to talk during the day about it. But it's, in a sense, a very simple story, not a complicated story. And a complicated story would be much more difficult to tell. This was rather straightforward to tell. The administration span a particular narrative, and what I think I've shown absolutely conclusively is that that narrative was wrong. The decision to move to coercive interrogation in plain violation of the Geneva Conventions and numerous other provisions of international law was not taken at the bottom. It came as a result of pressures from the top. The administration's narrative is contrary to that. They have scapegoated members of the American military in order to show that essentially the request for abusive interrogation came from the ground in Guantanamo. That is not the case. My book shows that. And the hearings that have been held since the book has come out in the House Judiciary Committee, in the Senate Armed Services Committee, in the Senate Judiciary Committee have confirmed that. Sure, we're all a bit frustrated that those committees have not gone further in what they have done, but an awful lot of material has come out that is deeply, deeply damaging to the administration's narrative. Second point, it was not a process, contrary to what the administration has argued, that was done with due care, deliberation, and process. It was done in a situation in which plainly the law was arranged around a predetermined fixed policy. The law followed the determination of the policy. The normal decision-making processes were short-circuited. The normal involvement in a consultative role through interagency discussions between the State Department and the Department of Defense never happened. The State Department was entirely cut out of the process. The senior military lawyers who would normally have been consulted and who would have expressed a view utterly opposed to that of the administration were simply cut out of the process. And I've stressed in many of the times that I've spoken, and I want to stress again and again and again, this is not the responsibility of the US military. Sure, there were a few junior members of the military who did things they should not have done. But as you go up the chain of command, no one, you will find that no one is more appalled about what has happened than senior members of the US military. I get emails regularly. One that I got recently, it was anonymized, that came from someone I knew well, trusted well, from a four-star serving Air Force general. It was a very short email, and it was addressed to a friend of mine, and it simply said, I've read Sands's book. I spent 5 years working with Addington and Haynes. His story tells precisely the circumstances of my engagement with them. I hope they both hang together. I was, in a sense, sort of rather shocked to get such an email. That is a four-star serving Air Force general. So don't for a moment think you are alone in your concerns about what is going on, neither alone in terms of the views of the rest of the world, nor alone even within some curious places in the upper echelons of the United States establishment. Sure. The third point that I'd make is that, contrary to the administration's narrative, the decisions at Guantanamo, only focusing on that, not on the CIA stuff, was not based on legal advice that came from Guantanamo. It was based directly on the legal advice that came from the Department of Justice, and for that reason, as has been explained, the DOJ is deeply implicated in what happened. But again, you need to understand that the normal decision-making processes in the Department of Justice were circumvented. People who worked in the Department of Justice, nonpartisan, who would normally have been involved in the deliberative process, were simply excluded. It was kept on a very tight hold, a very small group of people. In a sense, what has happened is a sort of coup d'etat. A very small group of people have taken control of what has happened. And the fourth myth that the administration has spun, which is also wrong, is that the decisions at Guantanamo had nothing to do with the pictures of abuse at Abu Ghraib. I think that is conclusively exploded as a myth. They did migrate. We've known and been able to show precisely the way in which that path of migration happened. And indeed, now you've got the Inspector General of the Department of Defense himself confirming recently that migration happened. So the bottom line of it is the administration's account is plainly wrong. It is self-serving. It is clear, I think, no reasonable person can conclude that the treatment of Mohammed al-Qahtani and others plainly violated the standards reflected in Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. That necessarily gives rise to a war crime, and the real issue that arises is what happens next. I get asked that pretty much everywhere I go, and each time that I've testified, I've been asked that. And again, I've been reluctant to go very far in what I say, because I'm conscious that as an outsider, what I have to say will be treated, you know, with a certain disdain by those who disagree with it, precisely because I'm an outsider. I think the simplest point that can be made is that the no-action option is not an option. The United States needs to get its house in order. There are different ways in which the United States can get its house in order. Congressional hearings are a start, but certainly not the end of the matter. There are various possibilities that are available. Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, commissions of inquiry, prosecutions. And as you know, various members of Congress have called, 54 members of Congress have called for the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate all of these issues. But hanging over all of this story, of course, is the recognition that the United States, like no other country, just like every other country, does not live alone in the world. We live in a globalized world order. Senator Pinochet found that out. The United States has joined up to various international conventions which criminalize certain actions, and other states have the possibility of acting. And what seems to have galvanized some of the members of the House Judiciary Committee the most is the chapter in my book which details the conversation that I had with a European judge and a European prosecutor, anonymized for obvious reasons, which went over the totality of the materials that I had gathered and which I've set out in the book, looking at the original documents. And when I asked them, have these people crossed the line? They said, yes, they have crossed the line. Are there grounds for investigating criminality? Yes, there are grounds for investigating criminality. Is this something you would look at? And at that point, they came back to a piece of legislation that has already been mentioned, which the European judge immediately said was a very stupid piece of legislation. And that was the Military Commissions Act 2006, which purports to grant some sort of immunity from investigation or prosecution to those involved in the promulgation of these interrogation techniques. Why is that stupid? It's stupid because it removes the principal obstacle to foreign investigations. For very sensible reasons, foreign prosecutors and judges don't like to get entangled in criminal matters in third countries. It's very difficult to prosecute. It's difficult to get witnesses to come over. It's difficult to get to the bottom of the facts. But the principal rationale is that there is a sensible policy principle which says it is first and foremost for those who are closest to the crimes to investigate and, if appropriate, to prosecute. But if that cannot happen, then we will investigate. And if necessary, we will prosecute. And I think that hangs over the entire story, the entire dreadful story that has happened in the last 5 years, the possibility of foreign investigation. And that, I think, ultimately is what will propel some administration, whatever color it is, to be forced to do something. And it's against that background that I welcome very much Dean Velvel's initiative at beginning the process of talking about these enormously important issues, because the eyes of many parts of the rest of the world are also on this issue. You're not alone in being deeply concerned about what has happened. Thank you very much.
Philippe Sands, QC, international law specialist and author of The Torture Team, speaking on September 13th in Andover, Massachusetts, at the Justice Robert Jackson Conference on the Planning for the Prosecution of High-Level American War Criminals. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll continue as the panelists, Lawrence Velvel, Josh Rattel, Chris Pyle, and Philippe Sands, take questions from the audience.
Hi, my name is Stanley Grossman. I actually came farther from California. I live in London. I'm a member of Democrats Abroad, which is an organization of hundreds of thousands of people living outside the United States, part of the Democratic Party. I'm also a member of the DNC. I'm very excited by the opportunity to hear these views. And my question is brief. Henry Kissinger cannot go to France. He's under indictment, or he's under threat of prosecution. And I was delighted by the last speaker's comment about the necessity or the opportunity for foreign prosecution, given that domestic prosecution has been somewhat precluded by the 2006 Act. And my obvious question is, there have been British and other European detainees who have been tortured in Guantanamo. Spain indicted Pinochet on the grounds that Spanish citizens had been murdered in Chile during the 70s. What would stop, say, a prosecution based in the UK using the same principle, and the demand for extradition of Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Gonzalez and all the other bad guys to the UK to face trial for these actions?